Sunt Eiji, Sunt Deho, Adam. Ja, es ist eine Weile her, oder? Und ich bin so ein bisschen traurig, dass keiner von euch Bitches irgendwie mal einen Kommentar hinterlassen hat. Naja, jetzt giere ich schon nach Resonanz. Das ist vielleicht verkehrt. Ich bin hier im Sai Family Restaurant. Das ist in Kojuem. Kojuem liegt gleich hinter Alduna. Alduna liegt gleich hinter Moira. Moira liegt gleich hinter Mapsa. Mapsa ist so die große, große Provinzstadt im Norden von Goa. Und ich fahre mit meinem E-Bike durch die Gegend, durch diese kleinen Straßen, Felder und diese alten Bungalows mit diesen unglaublich tiefen Veranden. Das ist echt irgendwie total, total irre. Sehen ganz verwunschen aus. Und warte auf Brutto Parab. Ich glaube, den Namen habe ich falsch ausgesprochen. Mit dem hatte ich neulich auf einer Party ein interessantes Gespräch über Literatur und Frauen und Männer in Indien. Und das Gespräch würde ich jetzt gerne mit ihm fortsetzen. Mal sehen, wo er bleibt. Der kommt noch mit einem Freund. Ja, Goa hat echt so ein ganz eigenes Flair. So im Hinterland, irgendwie so 10 Kilometer weit weg vom Strand, ist das alles sehr ländlich. Hat diese Bungalows, so kleinere Häuser und größere. In jedem Kaff steht eine große Kirche. Immer weiß, immer irgendwie barock. Ja. Was ich interessant finde, dass das Schnitzwerk in diesen barocken Kirchen oder neobarocken Kirchen natürlich von einheimischen Handwerkern gemacht wurde. Und manchmal sehen die Engel ganz schön indisch aus. Ha! Ah, da kommen sie mit dem Auto. Ich habe Ihnen gar nicht erzählt, dass ich es aufnehmen werde. Foto, I'm recording already.
That's okay.
Yeah,
that's Alan.
Hello, Alan. Hi. Nice to meet you. Hello, Brutto.
Hey, nice to meet you.
Yeah, this is a cycle. It's a very moody cycle. You it's like it goes off and goes on, like really. And I'm like completely stoned. Das ist ja nichts Neues für die Hörer und Hörerinnen. Ah, sehr schön. I was trying to get an outside place, but don't know. But they're still eating. Yeah. Ah, my goodness, Alan. I'm doing this like very briefly. I'm doing this this podcast for my German listeners. where are we?
We are in Kojuem.
Kojuem. Okay, that's how you pronounce it properly. Oh my goodness, it's a nice place.
Yes.
Will I get some Goan cuisine here?
Yes, you will. Yeah, okay. This is one of the grassroots places in Kojuem. Right?
Okay, nice, very nice. So what do you do, Alan?
I'm a creative director and a musician.
Oh my goodness, that sounds very impressive. Wow, I don't know. So what have you been working on, the latest stuff?
Yeah, currently me and Prutu are working on a sound installation by the river.
Okay, yeah. Wow, I would like to see it, but then it's like I'm leaving tomorrow, so I don't know. So by the river I just passed, coming from Alduna.
Yeah.
This river,
yeah.
This big river.
Yeah.
So what can we listen to at the sound installation?
So at the sound installation we're using mics placed in the earth and in the river. We're using hydrophones and geophones to modulate synthesizers to the rhythms of nature.
Wow.
So we the idea is to try and blur the line between what we regard as natural and what we call synthesized. you know. So it's that we're trying to skirt that uncanny valley where you can't tell whether a sound is of natural origin or is generated through oscillators. So we have both mixing there, and you can't tell what's coming from which source. And we're trying to get people to rethink what they call acoustic and what they call digital.
Isn't there also a whole body of mythology evolving around how sound came into the universe? That's like a dead end track, apparently. He just told me about the sound installation.
Oh, yeah.
Which I'm going to miss because I'm leaving.
Oh, when do you leave?
Tomorrow.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
So, I won't be able to.
Oh, cool. Would we caught up?
Yeah. I might be back in 2 weeks.
Okay. So. Are you going to Mumbai?
No, I'm going to Kerala.
Oh, to Kerala.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Ah, my goodness. So, the point is, please, tell me a little bit about yourself.
You want to get lunch?
Yes,
of course. Are you hungry? What would you like to eat?
Some Goan food.
I would like to just place an order and then we can
talk. Yes.
You need the thali?
Huh?
You need a thali?
Yeah, thali
is fine, no?
I need prawns biryani. Thank you. I've just ordered for all of us.
Okay, cool.
Okay.
Please, tell me about yourself.
My name is Prithu. I work in Goa as a teacher at a higher secondary school called Paradise, where I teach English language, literature, and critical thinking skills. But I'm also a musician and composer and sound engineer. So I do music for ads and films and theater and pretty much any audio application that I can get my fingers into.
My goodness.
So currently exploring sound art with my friend Alan.
You talked about it. I mean, two questions. One is, I watched, you were also involved in some Bollywood movies, no?
Yes.
So I watched this one, Tamash.
I worked on a film called Talash.
Yes.
With, I did the background.
With the haunter, yes,
that's right.
Talash.
Yeah.
What does it mean, Talash?
Talash is search.
Search.
Yeah, basically the search or the seeking.
So there's Salman Khan.
Amir Khan.
Amir Khan. Amir Khan.
Kareena Kapoor.
And
Kareena Kapoor.
What's his name again? Amir Khan plays this police officer
whose
son has drowned. He blames himself.
That's right.
And he also has to solve a weird case of suicide, not suicide, of a Bollywood actor. Who's seen driving a car and then he just turns and steers the car into the sea.
Right,
no apparent reason.
That's how the story begins.
Yes, exactly. And then Amir Khan encounters, because someone has to do with the red light district, prostitution. He encounters this very mysterious, very beautiful looking prostitute. Who is she played by?
Kareena Kapoor.
So, yeah. I mean, I saw her before. She's quite a big now. And she's, so her name is called Rosie. And it turns out that this is actually a ghost.
Yeah.
Which has been killed or like left to die by this Bollywood actor and his friends.
Yes,
and she basically, as a ghost, is responsible for him steering the car into the sea.
Right.
And at the end it turns out that he was communicating to this ghost. So you did the music for that?
I worked on the background score for that.
Okay.
At the time I was working as an assistant to a film composer called Ram Sampath, who's very well known and popular. And so I was his assistant. And so I did a lot of the major portion of the background score for the film.
Yeah.
And then I produced some of the songs on them. But like, obviously they're shared credits. But yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Talking about this movie, I mean, you have like this sort of very serious male who is troubled. You have his wife and they're trying to reassess their relationship. And then there's this mysterious woman and they have this very sort of...
Sort of like a mystic.
Yeah. So what does this movie tell me about the relationship of man and woman in Bollywood.
I think Aamir Khan is always, at least from his perspective, he feels like he's always telling modern stories. So, what does it tell you about the relationship in Bollywood, or does it tell?
No, I mean, what is it trying to? Indian society. Mm. I mean, Bollywood is a part of it.
I think he's trying to highlight for him over there. Like, it's trying to highlight a couple of things. It's,
for example,
I won't over intellectualize it. I think he's just trying to. I'm not going to over intellectualize it. I just feel like for them it was just, it's a cop story, right?
Yes.
And cops in India are traditionally known to be like, you know, just rough around the edges, like, you know, at home, and not expected to show sensitivity. So there's that aspect, right, of a male character showing sensitivity. And then I think the problems in the marriage is a modern narrative, because again, traditionally with the role like a policeman and his wife, you would expect the wife to be traditionally sort of subservient and, like, you know, and is under his thumb, so to speak, also because of his job and also because of his authoritative position, you know, of being that very alpha kind of male. And to have to show on screen the rift between, you know, a couple where it's not working out, you know, where there is the potential for infidelity.
Yes.
Like, you know, but and through that potential for infidelity, they still find a way to have to connect and reconnect their relationship, like, you know, when so just so the other woman here is, and I think that was ironic, the other woman is a ghost.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And so he's never really cheating on his wife. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he feels like he's cheated on his wife because he feels like he slept with a ghost. And
yeah.
So I mean, it's also this, like, kind of seems to be the psychological projection of his guilt outwards onto this ghost figure, right? I mean, you could take it like that, or you could call it a supernatural movie.
Yeah,
one of the two. I feel he's trying to build that social commentary in it. You know what I mean? It's just that, and it also then reinforces the stereotype of Indian marriages. And, you know,
I mean, but usually
You don't get divorced in the end. Everything ends happily. It's a happy ending.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
It doesn't end as a tragedy.
Yeah, but the tragedy only comes in when the lover is inaccessible.
Right, exactly. The lover is inaccessible, and that seems to be the tragedy, which is ironic because that wouldn't actually, within the narrative of the tragedy, wouldn't really be the point of it, right? The tragedy would then have to be like, I feel.
Okay.
Sure, it is, and you feel like it's an unrequited love, but within the Indian context, it's not a tragedy. You know what I mean? Like, it's in the Indian context, it's like, oh, the morality was saved. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That he didn't actually, and which is why he was then able to remain with his wife at the end.
Yeah.
Because he retains his moral high ground. He's never really slept with anyone. She was a ghost.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. I wish I could. Yeah, yeah. No, I really liked it.
It was also directed by a woman.
Okay.
And I feel like a queer woman at that. Rima is, I don't know if she's.
What's her name?
Rima Kagti.
Yeah.
And I don't know if she is openly queer, but she is a queer woman. But she is a woman director. I think making a film is like having a bunch of people walk into a room and having them breathe on a piece of meat expecting to cook steak.
Yeah.
Right? It's just.
I mean, The other thing I was wondering about, and I was discussing this with my host, who was. Musicians who are
kind of at the Peter Cat House.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, with Rohit and all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And no, I'm staying at Surya Khan's place. He's not staying
there.
Yeah,
yeah.
So anyway, and they were like discussing, they were practicing music last night, and they were discussing singing in English or Hindi. And so I was wondering about the significance, but the place of the English language. So it's like, I mean, like, for me, there is so much great English literature coming from the subcontinent.
Yes.
And for me, I also always understood Indian English to be like a proper idiom, to be like, you know, a proper sort
form.
Of language.
Yeah, huh? Yeah, a proper form of the language.
Yeah.
A proper interpretation
and
of it, if you will. Yeah.
So, what's the question here? How alien is English to you? Or is it not alien at all?
Man, actually, it's a very valid question, and it's like, I mean, they're different. Alan also will have an interesting take on it also, but like,
okay.
I feel like, for me, it's a sort of a post-colonial outlook, I question my association with the language. I'm an English literature major. I've done my master's in it.
Yeah.
And I love the language. I feel like I'm fluent in it, and I feel like because of me being fluent in it, I'm often mistaken for not being Indian in a lot of European countries. Yeah, and also by Europeans when they meet me in the country.
For sure, I would never only thing I would might mistake you for Pakistan, but not for somebody who doesn't come from the subcontinent.
No, but it's a very common misconception that I feel it's also this view that you hold is also based on the fact that you have traveled to India so much.
Yeah.
And so then you know what the subcontinent is actually like.
Yeah.
But to the uninitiated or for people, India is just another third world country, right? And so then when you speak, like for example, I worked in London for a few months.
Yeah.
And in Edinburgh for a few months. And while I was there, people would talk to me and think I was from Birmingham. And they insisted I was from Birmingham. And I was like, no, I'm not from Birmingham.
But
like,
that's actually a compliment.
No,
like if somebody
it?
No,
why
would
is it? Why is it a compliment?
Because you are staying at a place and you are mistaken for a local.
No,
I mean, it's
I don't,
the best thing.
I know. Why. It's a lack of... it's myopic, right?
Okay.
It's short-sighted. It's short-sighted for them to not be able to see that somebody from the subcontinent does have that. Because A... for obviously, especially in the UK, especially because you must know your own history and the impact of it on the rest of the world, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, so you should know that the English language is exported hundreds of years ago before, you know, and so people obviously know how to fucking use it, right? And so, and it's okay. And I get that a lot, and I get it a lot from Americans more than I did from the UK, but like it did happen in the UK. But that being said, it's contentious because as you start to grow up, you realize that it's not your own, right? And then, but it is also a currency that you must sort of use and spend. But at the same time, I speak three other regional languages, right? You know, so there's, I speak Hindi, Marathi, and Gujarati. And I read and write in all of them as well. So, I don't know. Most of the media I've been exposed to, most of the culture that I've been exposed to, most of my influences have been in English, the music that I listen to, even though I studied classical music, Indian classical music as a child, I hated it. And I hated it because I'd heard Michael Jackson and I wanted to play the piano and my parents gave me a harmonium, you know, and it was like, I don't know. But today I make work that sort of tries to address that question. So, interestingly, I was reading Ngugi Wa Thiong'o. Do you know?
No.
He's a Kenyan author.
Yeah.
Very famous because he was part, at one point, involved in the Mau Mau Rebellion that happened in Kenya, which was basically the uprising against the British. And he was jailed for two of his works in English by the Kenyan government. And in that, he started to realize that even him as an English writer, you know, was a threat to his government, even as an English writer.
Yeah.
And so then from that day, he switched to writing in Gikuyu. And so all his work is now written in Gikuyu and is then translated into English.
Yeah.
And so then I feel that's also something to consider, right? Is that while there are Indian writers who write in English and who are proficient in it from the subcontinent, personally, I don't feel all of them have that kind of control over the language, which is why I suggested Shubhangi Swarup to you that day, right? Because I've read Indian writers on the subcontinent, there's good stuff, right? But then the most, a lot of it is diaspora. There's the diaspora, the Indians living abroad, right?
Oh, but I mean,
writing from outside about the inside, right?
Okay.
The local fiction stuff is a lot of like, meh. Wouldn't want to read it, like a lot of the local stuff. And not to say, that's my opinion again, and that's the problem with it, right? I have this view because I've been bred on so much good English literature that I have a perspective on Indian writing in English about it not being good, wherein I feel that I am doing a disservice to my fellow countrymen to have to say that, because at the end of the day, whatever they are doing is still connecting with other people. It's still a language to have to tell stories in. It's still sharing narratives, right? So it's contentious. I don't know if there's a clear answer to it.
Yeah, I mean, like, I would totally argue with you because, like, I mean, like, even if you read somebody like Winton Bistri, who is now living in Canada, yes, but I mean, he wrote from India.
He did at one point.
Yeah.
And I'm not, Winton Bistri is great writing.
I mean, like, come on. And his
stuff that he's dealing with is great, but there's a lot of Indian writing in English that isn't very good.
Yeah, which probably I'm...
And it's not even very good. For me, as an English major, what I see in it is the vernacular in the English.
Yeah.
The use of the vernacular. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Tone, grammar, construction.
Yeah.
I'm seeing sentence construction that's clunky. you know, images that are not clearly put out, but you can sense that they're trying to come out.
Okay, you know what I mean?
Like, so there's imagery, there's visualization.
Kiran Nagarkar, who also wrote...
Kiran Nagarkar is great.
Right?
So there are good writers.
But
Before prose, literature.
Yes.
You know what I mean? There are stories and there's fiction and there's pulp. And there's that, but then prose and literature, very few people write. Like Siddharth Dhanman Sanghvi is another one who also lives here in Goa right now.
Yeah, okay.
He's written The Lost Flamingos of Bombay. Beautiful, beautiful writing, beautiful prose. Jeet Thayil also, who travels a lot. Amazing prose. Narcopolis was such a moving book.
Yeah, it's
like, especially if you like Bombay and
I really like it a lot.
It's, and he's like, there's poetry in his writing.
Oh, there's a book, because I usually conduct these sort of interviews while I'm stoned, so there's always a nice reference. But you were being mentioned, Alan. You take on the language.
I feel an important dimension to also consider when you ask, when you try to understand why English is so widely spoken in India and even looked up to as a reference language, is that India is... very diverse. I mean, the dialect changes every few kilometers.
Yeah.
And so there is the widely held belief that Hindi is a uniting language is a misconception. Hindi is a divisive language in many parts of this country. And so a lot of people...
North and South.
I would even call the Northeast a different... I would call them a different sector altogether because of the uniqueness and the remoteness of that region.
And all the languages that they have in
there. Yeah, so I feel like what it's not like every state adopts Hindi as willingly. It's a slow process for Hindi to become the national language, and we're not there yet. So English stands in for that one common language that can be spoken from all of these different states that call themselves India. But we actually should be called a federation of Indian states because that's how diverse the states are.
But it's still called a union. So you have the word union in the official name, right? I mean, isn't India called a union?
That's what we're saying. We're saying it should be called an Indian Union.
But it's not.
Because that's more how, like, how the reality is more like that.
Yeah.
So English is a good stand-in, is a non-political... I mean, obviously, it's deeply political also because it is post-colonial, but... Right now, when Hindi is being politicized so much, English becomes that non-less political force. And then obviously, it's the language of commerce.
Yeah.
So.
And also you notice now, for example, our Prime Minister, he goes out to every single international conference and will speak only in Hindi. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's a statement that he's trying to make at a very political level also, right? Is to have to, defy the colonial influence of the language upon the nation and its nationhood, right? And who am I as a leader, right? Whereas up until him, every single prime minister has spoken in English, right? What would you consider that? From a political standpoint, it's a kind of indifference, right? Or a deference on their side.
But I'm stuck by the idea of making a language which has arrived here as a foreign language your own, but that's probably some sort of a misconception from my side.
No, it's not a question of not making it our own. I feel like, to be fair, if you take India as a... if you take anything outside of the UK, anything outside of Great Britain who speak English, they didn't really have much of a choice whether they should or shouldn't. Mm-hmm. You see? Mm. And today, it's not like... kids younger than me, like, and younger than us, the children, especially from the more backward socio-economic classes, it's not like they have a choice. They're not given the choice to not speak English, you see. If they don't speak English, then they are automatically cementing their feet into their current socio-economic position. There is no mobility, right? And so then who has a choice there? How can you say, you know what I mean? There is mastery, and then that mastery comes with it, and there is art that is created from it, because that is the nature of language, right? It is just a medium of expression. But if one had to think about quality and whose words and whose story, it starts to become political as a narrative, you see. And that political narrative is complicated when it comes to the history of English in India and the history of English generally, right? In terms of its bastardization of other languages, how it has borrowed and grown and you know, like evolved more than any other language. It has evolved and borrowed and colonized words, you know what I'm saying? Like words have literally been colonized into the Indian language and into the English language. And if you'll study the history of the language, you'll see a lot of it has come through conquest and war and bloodshed and, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. So, but so it's contentious for me. I want to explain.
Is what you call colonization? Of like, are you referring to the typical, stereotypical Urdu or Hindi words which became part of the English language?
That like, is definitely there. But I'm saying also from across the world, right? So many influences of words that have been borrowed from other cultures.
Yes, of course.
That's what I'm interested in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
but
I,
here in but India, as far as the colonization of the languages goes. I feel at an artistic level, we have often sought validation from the West.
Okay.
Also, you know?
Yeah.
And into have to, but and that's not why, but we are so cool, we are so good in our own right, you know what I mean? There's so much to say and so much, and such a big audience to reach out to, actually. So that's the way I feel like what Suryakant did was amazing. Because he was the first one for me, as a musician also, to bridge that gap, to start singing in Hindi, singing electronic music that otherwise belongs to a very specific demographic in the country.
Okay.
Yeah, to make electronic music that belongs to a specific demographic, but sing it and present it in Hindi, in also something that is reminiscent of the kind of music that my parents grew up listening to. It sounds like Mohammad Rafi. He has such a Mohammad Rafi kind of voice, if you've heard Mohammad Rafi.
Yes, 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 really.
And but that
never struck me, but okay, okay.
And I remember that for me. I remember going for one of his gigs in Bombay, for his Lifafa gig in Bombay.
Yeah.
And for the first time at a gig in Bombay, I have seen... Usually you go to gigs in Bombay and you know where you're going. Like say if you'll go to Antisocial or you'll go to Social, you'll know what kind of crowd you're going to meet. Who's come there for the music. Right?
Well, Social is like a cafe in Bandra,
yes,
right?
Place, I have right, been there. So if you're going to Social, you know how who's going to be there, right? But when I went for Suryakant's gig to this little club in Bandra somewhere, there were people from everywhere. There were lawyers and accountants and Hindi-speaking Bollywood-listening people and like, you know, who wouldn't otherwise engage with electronic music, and all of them had heard his music and liked it. So that for me was amazing. He bridged a very modern, Western-influenced style of music, which is the electronic house music, right?
Yeah.
And put himself into it as being the performer, but then also carried forward the heritage and the language with it. And it didn't seem forced. You know, it's not like there wasn't somebody before who did that, but for me it didn't seem forced.
So listen, also lieber...
It seemed crisp. And crisp. I think that was really interesting.
Das Essen ist gekommen. Was haben wir? What are we eating? Like, I think
this is Bombay duck. Bombay duck. It has fish. Fried fish, and this is prawns. This has bones in the middle, but they're very soft, and you can just eat
okay.
them.
Okay, das ist toll. Also Fisch mit weichen Kräten. Das finde ich super. Also, I think I should finish this off. It's already half an hour, and I want to talk to you. I don't want to exploit you too much. liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, ja, das war ein Mittagessen in Goa. Hm, ja, mit Leuten hierher gezogen sind. When did you move here, by the way?
2.5 years ago.
2.5 years ago. You go, okay, and what about you?
Similarly, like similarly. 1.5, 2 years ago.
Genau, einer von diesen neuen Goa-Leuten, ja. Hey, das war's, liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer. Ja, bis demnächst.